पावताय पतिबोधिताम भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन कृतिताम पुराण मुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीम् अम्बत्वामनुसन्धतां भगवद्गीते भवद्वैषिणी. भक्त्या त्वनन्यया शक्यः अहमेवं विधोर्जुन ज्ञातुं द्रष्टुं च तत्त्वेन प्रवेष्टुं च परन्तप. भक्त्या तु अनन्यया शक्यः अहम् एवं विद्धः अर्जुन ज्ञातुं द्रष्टुं च तत्त्वेन प्रवेष्टुं च परन्तप. Remember in the previous verse, Krishna said, I'm not able to be known by the Vedas, by the study of the Vedas, the Veda Dhyayana. I'm not able to be known by the Vedas, by the performance of tapas, by austerities, by dana, by giving charities, or even by worship, yajya. I'm not able, says, I'm not able to be seen, he says, I'm not able to be seen in this manner, in the way that I've shown myself to you. He says, drishtavanasi, as you have seen me, he says, drishtavanasi mam yata, in the same way that you have been able to see me, right? I'm not able to be seen in that way by others. Through what means? Through, just to say, study of the Vedas. The Vedas aren't going to give you that drishti, that vision. No amount of austerities will give you that vision. No amount of giving or charities or any of these things, or no amount of worship, is going to result in that vision of the Vishwasarupa, the way that you've seen me, the way that I've given you that, what we call that divya chakshu. I've given you that divine eye that has allowed you to see in this way. But then, so then the question is, he says, katam, Shankara introduces this verse saying, katam punaha shakya. Well then, how then is the Lord able to be seen? In what manner? So here, Uchite, here it said, he says, so Krishna says to Arjuna, hey Arjuna, Arjuna is Avakara, aham evam vidyaha, I in this manner, in this way that I've shown you, aham evam vidyaha, shakyaha, I am able to be seen by a bhakti, bhaktya is the instrumental, by a bhakti, by a devotion, two there, see the two, bhaktya, two, ananyaya. I'm able to be seen by a bhakti, which is ananyaya, which has no competition at all. Anya means other. Ananya means not another. By a devotion, which has no other subject. So by a devotion which is focused only on me. In other words, that certainly isn't the situation in life. You're devoted. You have desire, you have passion toward, you have commitment to many different things. Right? But here the commitment, the passion, the desire, the love, the relationship really is single-pointed. It's ananya. It's a bhakti that has no other, that is not focused on anything other than Bhagavan, than Ishwara. So by that single pointed bhakti, he says, jnatum drashtum cha. I am able not only to be jnatum, to be seen, to be known. It's not just a knowledge, a theoretical knowledge, for you to know about Ishvara. It's jnatum, the being able to be known, which is also drashtum, able to be known, to be seen. To be seen means the knowledge that that you're able to gain is what we call a paroksha jnanam. Not paroksha, not indirect knowledge. Like you could study the whole Vedas yourself and get a very good idea of how the Vedas describe Ishvara and how the Vedas describe the universe, what they have to say about Ishvara, what they have to say about the universe, what they have to say about you, that in fact, you are limitless. Right? Ishvara is limitless, you are limitless, the self that you are is the self of Ishvara. All of these things you can study in the Vedas, you can study the Upanishads, and you can gain some sort of paroksha jnanam. Paroksha jnanam means indirect knowledge, and you can be a scholar. You can say, this is what the Upanishads say. But that's not drashtum, that's jnatum, you can know. But drashtum means a knowing which is a paroksha, which is seen, where you recognize the truth of it, where you not just recognize, it's a recognition. Let me be clear on this. You know, everybody knows the tenth man story. You all know the tenth man story, okay. A beautiful story for understanding the difference between paroksha jnanam, indirect knowledge, and direct knowledge. When the old man meets, sees that there's a problem there, and he approaches the leader, you know, he says initially to the leader, I know where the tenth man is. I can show you the tenth man. And he's, Swamiji will go on and on about this particular part. Because when he says, the leader says, I know where the tenth man is. Or he can just say, the tenth man is fine. Nothing has happened to the tenth man. All is well. Right? So here the old man says that. Now, this old man is not a feeble old man. He's a wise old man. He's strong. He seems completely sane. He seems very confident. And so when he says these words to the leader, the tenth man is fine, there's no problem, I can show him to you. The leader actually does get some relaxation from that. You know, and some shred, has some shraddha in the old man. Ah, the tenth man is, this old man knows where the tenth man is. Okay, everything's going to be all right. So there's a relaxation. But the next question is, please show him to me. Right? Since we know that he is and I have shraddha in you. And that makes a huge difference because I was really upset and very, very worried. Now I know that he is, but could you please show me? Okay. So that's the difference. Paroksha jnanam. Now, when we talk about what is going to happen here for the tenth man and for us in reference to this knowledge is what we call aparoksha jnanam. Because the aparoksha jnanam means the knowledge that you're going to gain is not an indirect knowledge, but it's also not the knowledge of someone else, right? So there's not going to be really a subject-object relationship with this knowledge, because in fact the knowledge is of you, the one who is already completely here present. And so now we can say this type of knowledge, we can use the word recognition. You know, recognition, because I am going to gain knowledge of myself, but it's really the word recognition, it becomes very meaningful because I'm going to recognize something that has always been here. So you can imagine the tenth man's situation when he says, okay, well, please show him to me then. That is wonderful news. Please show him to me. And the old man, now he doesn't just show him. He counts out the other nine boys. And in counting out the other nine boys, what he's done is remove all possibilities. all of the other possibilities, so that when he says to the tenth man, you are the tenth man, the tenth man can't say, no, no, there's only nine of us. That option has been totally eliminated because all of the other nine have been counted. And so when he says, you are the tenth man, there's nothing that mind can do except say, ah, I'm the tenth man. But it's a recognition of a fact that was present even before the old man said, you are the tenth man. That fact was already totally 100% experientially present. Nothing new experience has been gained, but there's been the removal of ignorance that had caused me not to put two and two together, not to put tenth manness together with the experience of me, right, as the tenth man. That was the problem. And so there's a contextualization here. There's not a new experience. There's a recognition of the experience that's already here. That recognition is what we call the recognition of something that is already present and is not something that can be objectified like a sense perception. That's what we call aparocignanam. It's an immediate, direct knowledge. So here, tenth man's story, no drishtanta, no illustration is perfect because actually the tenth man can see that body with his eyes. But he already was seeing this body with his eyes. Yeah, that didn't do the trick. What he needed was those words to point at him, having eliminated all of the possibilities. And at that time, he got direct, immediate knowledge, and aparoksha jnana. And so here, when we say jnatum drashtum, it's not the jnatum of any type of intellectual knowledge. It's the jnatum, the knowledge of seeing something as it is in reality. Okay, so now I went a little farther with the aparoksha jnanam using the tenth man story, but let me just bring it to this situation. Right now, here, in this experience, just the experience of the room, what is this really? He says, tattvena, what is this really? It's Ishvara. There is nothing in this room that is not Ishvara. And so, in fact, your experience is the experience of Ishvara. Okay. Now, if I'm going from just taking this room from the standpoint of Arjuna before knowledge and the whole first part of the chapter 11 here, Arjuna was experiencing this room as though like this, you know, I am experiencing Ishvara. I, Arjuna, am experiencing Ishvara in the form of this room. Oh, this whole thing, the entirety of my experience is Ishvara. But there's something else that has to happen for that knowledge to be aparoksha, and for that knowledge to be absolutely complete. And why one of the reasons in this, when Krishna gave Arjuna the whole Vishwasarupa, Arjuna was looking at it and filled with fear. He was looking at Ishvara, remaining himself outside of Ishvara. He had a vision of Ishvara, but Arjuna had a vision of Ishvara that Krishna had allowed him to have through this Divya Chakshu. But Arjuna stayed outside of the vision and then had an emotional response to the vision. This is our experience all of the time. It may not be as dramatic, but this is our experience. When I'm experiencing this room, I, the jiva, Radha, am experiencing this room. Right? I am experiencing you. But what has to happen, so I remain that kita jivatvam as an individual in the room, experiencing the room. Now I can even say, as I get my little knowledge, I can say, you know, I see all of this as Ishvara. But that is not Vedanta. All of this is Ishvara, but you are leaving something out. The tenth man was leaving himself out. Right? We are leaving ourselves out. So what does it mean in this experience of the room, Tathwena, to really understand, to really know, to really see, to really experience this as Ishvara, what has to happen is that the whole jiva, the body, mind, sense organs, has to be thrown into the room. It has to be included in the room as though it isn't. I mean, just think about it. In this room, are you not as included in the room as everything else in the room? There's nothing that's left out. There's no part of, like, you can see your body, and I'm looking at all of your bodies, all of your sense organs. I can kind of see your thoughts ticking away. I'm aware, aware of little Tibby, okay? Then we're aware of the whole thing. But I'm equally aware of what I'm doing, my body, my sense organs, the thoughts that are going on, the whole thing. There's no separation, really, between myself in the room and yourself in the room. In fact, this totality is Ishvara, you know? And so then, who is the self in the room? So look at the situation. If everything in this room is Ishvara, I'll even put it like this. Everything in this room, all bodies, all beings, make up the creation equally. It's not that you're more in this creation than I am. Think of it like this. If you have a dream, there are many dream characters in the dream, and you may be one of them. But in terms of order of reality, all of the dream characters are exactly equal and are part of the warp and woof of the dream. Not only that, the entire dream, right, is of the same order of reality, as is everything in it. It's just that the entire dream projection is a projection of the whole, and then everything that's in it, if you make it like a, almost like a tapestry, the dream tapestry, everything is equally in it and equally a part of it, no more, no less. Even if you take the smallest mosquito or an atom or a huge mountain, you know, or all of the different living beings of all sorts, humans and reptiles and whatever, all things in the dream are part of the warp and woof of the same show, of the same picture. No one is more or less. Now you can say that even like this. No one is more or less, including the individual in the dream and the whole dream. It's all part of the same tapestry. You can say, oh, well, this is a bigger part. This is the whole tapestry, and all of these things in it are part and parcel of that tapestry. That's true, but they're all part of the tapestry, and they all enjoy exactly the same order of reality. Not one is more or less. And when the dream comes, the whole thing comes, and the dream goes, the whole thing goes into a manifest condition. So now, if I ask, okay, that being so, the dream, it's easy to see, and I say, who is the self of the dream? Now, if I were to say, well, it's my dream, and I'm the character in the dream, so I'm the real self in the dream, because I took a dream character in the dream, so I'm the self of the dream. Who are you talking about? Are you talking about, because this is the situation we have here in this room, are you talking about, say, in this room, you know, I am identified with this body in this room, so I am really, in terms of my experience, I am the self in this room. So now look at it from the dream standpoint. There's many characters in your dream, and you've taken a character in the dream. So you can say, if I ask you that question, who is the self in the dream? What if you were to say, well, the one whom I'm identified with is the self in the dream. Who is that one? You know, that character that I was identified, that's the self in the dream. Is that the self in the dream? Seriously, is that the self in the dream? What you would say is that, well, within the dream, I was experiencing the dream from that standpoint, the standpoint of that upadhi. But then everybody else would say, but I was experiencing that same dream from the standpoint of my upadhi. And my upadhi means the body, mind, sense organs. Everybody's going to say exactly the same thing. But since I have a special, like in this room, I'm talking right now, and I have a special relationship with this body. But of course, you would say, yeah, but I have a special relationship with this body. It's all exactly the same. See what I mean? It's all part of the tapestry. So now if I ask, in reference to the dream, really think about it, who is the self of the dream, and where does that self abide? Who is the self of the dream, and where does that self abide? Well, it's a kind of an odd question. Because, and the one lucky thing for Vedanta is having a teaching tool. The dream is considered such a major teaching tool. You know, you are, now that we're in the waking state, we're able to think back and, well, what was really going on in that dream? Right? So that is, the dream is like the Achilles heel to this reality. Because when you think, well, what was really going on in that dream? Well, actually, the whole dream, the whole warp and woof came from me. And I was the self of the whole dream. Not of any given part of the dream. I'm the truth of the whole dream. I'm the set, I'm the being of the whole dream. I'm the conscious being the whole dream enjoys. And I'm also free of the whole dream. Because when the dream goes away, I'm still there. He says you have exactly the same situation if you have an imagination. If you have an imagination, like if I ask you to imagine a meadow, you have the imagination of the meadow and all the beings in the meadow, it's obvious, and you don't even think about it really, that you are the self of the entire imagination and all the characters in it. Even if you were to identify with one, so you get into a daydream and you identify with one. Still, it's very clear that that's mitya, that in fact, everything enjoys equally your being. That's our situation here. Everything equally enjoys our being. But the dehatma buddhi means the identification of the one who's talking. Now here I am talking. The identification that this body, mind, sense organs has with this particular upadhi is profound. It is a profound identification. And the identification that your body, mind, sense organs has with consciousness, the conscious being the me, is profound. Because as long as your mind is with this body, you know, this mind, as long as it's awake, is going to be saying, I am a conscious being. When in the whole dream, every character is saying, I'm a conscious being, I'm a conscious being, I'm a conscious being. But when the dream goes away, what's left? One conscious being. The me of every character in the dream. But is a dream character going to see that? Why would a dream character see that? Because the dream character's experience is only of itself being a conscious being. Like if I hold a mirror up to the sun, the sun, as long as the mirror is there, and as long as it's sunny out, right, that sun is going to be reflecting in that mirror. You know? And so the mirror is experiencing itself as having the sun. That's its experience. Okay? It has to experience itself somehow without the sun in order to have any viveka there. But an awake mind is always experiencing consciousness. So why should it think that the consciousness is free of it? Because it is never free of the consciousness. As long as the mind is up, it has consciousness. Right? And so why shouldn't it think, I am the conscious being? If whenever it's up and awake, it has consciousness. Every thought has consciousness, every emotion has consciousness, every feeling has consciousness. And for all we know, this mind that always has consciousness only exists when this body is there. We don't know that this conscious mind that I have will still be here when this body goes. But as long as the mind is awake, you know, the sense organs are up and functioning, then the mind and the body and the sense organs are all one unit. That is the experience from the standpoint of the body-mind. And so that's why from the standpoint of the Upadhi, the conditioning adjuncts, the Dehatma Buddhi, this conviction, here Buddhi means conviction, the certainty that the Atma is the body, you know. It's a certainty, it's a conviction. I am this. It's such a conviction that we don't even think about it. You just take that for granted. Mm. Now, that has so many implications. If you take this as it's a certainty, then even in terms of gaining liberation, you know, and here Arjuna wants to gain knowledge, you know, but the mind is saying, I, the conscious being, Arjuna, this me, wants to gain knowledge. And he says, you know, I understand all of this and everything you say. I know that it's the truth. I have that shraddha. I know that it's true. That's what he said. He said, but do you think you could show me, if you don't mind, if you think it would be all right? He says, would you show me your whole Vishwa Sarupa, what that's like, you know? And he asked with all sincerity, but it's Arjuna the Jiva asking, I understand that you are Ishvara, and I understand, I have that Shraddha. Could you please show me your Vishwasarupa? And so Krishna granted him that vision. But Arjuna, the mind that has the Dehatma Buddhi, you know, was granted that vision. And so little Arjuna, Bhagavan gave him the vision of Ishvara. And so now Arjuna has, as though, knowledge of Ishvara, except that he's excluded himself. Right? And so, in fact, that isn't knowledge of Ishvara. That's why here he says, Tatvena, in reality, I can show you this. In reality, but what is required? What is really required to see this? It's, I can only be seen in this way by a person who has a bhakti, a devotion to me, for which there is nothing outside. It's a bhakti or a devotion which has nothing in competition with it. Because whatever is in competition with it creates dvaita. Because I love you and I have so much devotion for you, Bhagavan, but could you please bless me to have this? Right? Now, could you please bless me so that I could have this? You know? Because I want this. You know, and this would really make me happy. And I know that you're Bhagavan, and I know that you're the Lord. So could you give me these things? Okay, now, as soon as that happens, then there's something which I am not. Immediately, because I don't have that. So now not everything is Bhagavan. I can say, everything I experience is Bhagavan, but could I have this, you know? And could you grant me that? So, in fact, in one text, Shankara ends, I forget the name of the text, it's just a little like a question-answer text. In the end, it says, what is knowledge really? What is jnanam really? What's it is vairagya? Vairagya, what vairagya means? Vairagya translates as dispassion. But without that vairagya, let's look at what the lack of the vairagya means, is basically, I want this. I have vairagya toward this, and I have vairagya toward that. I have vairagya toward this, but I want this. And so what does that mean? I'm here, that's there. What does that mean? I am a jiva who is experiencing the lack of this. So if you start really contemplating on what that means to have vairagya, it means that there is nothing here that is not Ishvara. This is Ishvara, this is Ishvara, this is Ishvara, this is Ishvara, my sense organs are Ishvara, my emotions are Ishvara, My mind is Ishvara. There is no experience that is not Ishvara. And then who is the self? I am the self of this, I am the self of this, I am the self of this, I am the self of this. That's the Ananya Bhakti. So my whole life then becomes one in relationship to Ishvara. You see that? Otherwise, it's my whole life, all of my experience is an experience of Ishvara, or I am asking Ishvara to give me something. That's the thing. And so here he's saying, you know, it's only through this Ananya Bhakti, when I don't see anything other than Ishvara, right, that in reality, and then he says, that really one is able to know, and one a knowing which is seen. And then he says, and one is able to enter me, praveshtum. To enter me means moksha, liberation. Because, in fact, I am entered. In reality, I am entered. Like, in this room, am I any less a part of the room than anyone else? Am I any less, is this body, mind, sense organs any less a part of the creation than anything else? And that, if that's so, then where is the self? So we put it like this. Where is myself? Who is myself in this situation? If everything within duality is equally Ishvara, that means every single part of you, your body, mind, sense organs, moods, emotions, unconscious, doesn't make any difference what it is, all of that is equally Ishvara. Then who are you? If you have a dream, everything in the dream is equally the dream. There's no part that is not the dream. So then, who are you? Who are you, the conscious being? And so, it's easy to recognize in the dream, it's easy to recognize in your imagination, but now here, in this room, if I say, who are you, and you actually see who you are, and yatum drashtum, then what does that mean in terms of your experience? What are you seeing? And just think about it for a minute. In your experience right now at this moment, when you think of you, your own being, the me, where does it stop and where does it, where are its parameters? Where in your experience right now of this room, where do you stop? Where do you start and where do you stop?
In my body.
Your physical body is in your experience, right? The physical body is known. Just like the physical body is known, the rug is known, the space is known, your thoughts are known, all of these things are known, right? All of these things exist in your awareness. Is that true? Right now, everything that you're experiencing, it exists in your awareness, right? Okay, so say you just let yourself for a minute just focus on your own presence, the awareness that you are, and everything that you're experiencing exists in that awareness. Is that true or not? I would say it has to be true, or it wouldn't be in your experience. Right? So now just focus on that fact, that everything that you're experiencing right now, it's not just your body that you're experiencing that exists in your awareness, absolutely everything that you're experiencing on every level, exists in your awareness. Now, is there any part of this experience that exists away from your awareness? Any part at all in your experience right now that exists away from your awareness? You have to say no, because otherwise it's not in your experience. If it's in your experience, it must be in your awareness. So what here in this experience is away from you? You can't have an experience that's away from you. Now, but there's something to notice here. That's true. There is no experience that you can have that's away from you. You're equally pervasive to every part of your experience. But now, the other inner, so that's just a fact. If you just sit with it for a minute, you have to say, even though you're, that Dehatma Buddhi, that Buddhi is the conviction and the Atma is the Deha, is so strong. Nevertheless, you have to say that you have no experience that has away from awareness. If it was away from awareness, you would be having experience. So that's a fact. But there's another thing to notice, that the experiences that I'm having are continually changing. Right? Like if I'm looking here, I can say, now everything, say I'm looking this way, everything in my experience, everything that I'm experiencing right now is in my awareness. And so nothing is away from me. So I can say everything right now is in me, nothing is away from me. But if I look this way, I say the same thing. Everything that I'm experiencing is in me, nothing is away from me, right? But when you go from this experience to this experience, just visual now, this experience to this experience to this experience, there are a lot of things that are left along the way. But what isn't left is you. That's why you can figure out who you are. because you're leaving all every experience behind all of the time, except for one, which is me, the awareful being. That is never left behind. That's why we use these illustrations as the waking state. You know, you can look at all the changing experiences in the waking state. Everything changes except for you. Experiences come and go, mental experiences, moods, emotions, all of them come and go in you. And you are the self of all of them, because all of them exist in your awareness. There's, you can never be aware from, away from being, never can be away from awareness, the awareful being. But you can go from the waking state, different experiences in the waking state, through time when you were a little girl or a little boy, to growing up. You can say, yes, I was the little boy. I was the teenager. You know, I was the adult. I was the little girl. You know, I was the teenager. I was the 20-year-old. That I remains constant. Or I was in India, you know, or I've traveled through Europe, or I went away to school. So I, always me though. I am the one that was there having those experiences. I was happy yesterday and then I was agitated and then I became all right. But I was the one. I'm always the constant. I don't go away when these experiences go away. Whether it be through time or through when I'm just changing my vantage point, I'm always, always, always the same. Who is that one that survives even the waking state to the dream state to the deep sleep state back to the waking state? Even though these experiences totally negate each other, I survive. I am the self of all of them. And so to know yourself, to recognize yourself, it's a recognition. We are so used to taking our, to have that Dehatma Buddhi where I become one who is experiencing the world rather than recognizing the whole world is in me. I always I'm only going from this standpoint, looking at myself as a finite being within this world rather than recognizing I am the constant. I am the me, the very personal me, is the constant of the whole dream. Of the whole creation. That was Arjuna's problem. You know, for Arjuna really to appreciate Ishvara, Arjuna has to recognize I am Ishvara. That's what Krishna is telling him here. You know, but to be able to do that, everything has to be Ishvara. That's why he says that Ananya Bhakti, that's saying, Everything, without any exception, has to be Ishvara. That's where your devotion is. Wherever you look, you see Ishvara. What does that mean, really? You have to get very personal about this. You can say, whenever I look at any experience in the world, that is Ishvara. And you look at it as Ishvara. Then you have to look at all of your sense organs. They're Ishvara. You have to look at your thoughts in your mind. That is Ishvara. You have to look at your emotions. That is Ishvara. This whole thing on every dimension is Ishvara. And then who am I? I am Ishvara. There is nothing that is not Ishvara. So you look at the mind looks outward. Outward means it looks at the universe, the Ishvara. It looks internally at the different thoughts and moods and emotions and subtle planes, Ishvara. It looks at the self, me, Ishvara. There's only Ishvara. And what is my relationship to Ishvara? Not, oh my God, there's Ishvara. Ishvara again. That's why bhakti. And it'll come in the next verse too. It's that bhakti. Bhakti means love. Love and devotion. You know, bhakti doesn't have to do with... bhakti is not neutral. You know, like in the world, most things of your experience, in fact, are neutral. You don't care. You know, there's just another thing. There's a handful of things in the world that you care about, that you love, that are important to you, that you love. So you could say, there's a number of things in the world that I love, that I am devoted to, that I protect, that I would do anything for. Like a mother will say that about her child, do anything for my child. Her father would say that, you know. You can say that about your guru. Some people have that tremendous bhakti toward their guru. They'll do anything for my teacher. That type of thing is there very much in India. Would do anything. I love that person so much. I care so much about that person. You know? There's that heart is there, that bhakti. Or the Ishtadevata, you know, for a religious person. I love so much. Or it can be toward nature. You know, where there's that love and there's that commitment, that's bhakti, you know. Devotion, where that matters. You care. And so, in Swamiji, I read his commentary on this. He says, you know, a person starts out having diverse bhakti. I'm very devoted to my money. I'm very devoted to my money. I take care of it, you know. I keep it safe.
I count it.
I count it. I spend time with it. I do pujas to it. I ask Bhagwan, you know. I'm devoted to my family. I'm devoted to my children. You know, I have different things that I'm devoted to. But what he says is, as time, for a mumukshu, for a seeker, more and more, the weight goes more and more to seeing money as Ishvara, seeing my family as Ishvara, seeing my pet as Ishvara, you know, all of these things get subsumed. It doesn't mean that you love them less. It's not about that, oh, I love Ishvara, I don't love you. It's not that. That's Dvaita again. It's just that all of these little devotions become contained in Ishvara. Become consumed, become eaten by, in a sense, eaten by Ishvara. And that gives actually a lot of, as Swamiji will say, that gives a tremendous amount of freedom. Gives a tremendous amount of freedom to you when you see the upadhi itself as Ishvara. You see your relationships as Ishvara. You see the complexities of life as Ishvara. because that's what it is. It's not like it's the complexities of life and over here and Ishwara standing over here on the side, you know, looking down. I'll be devoted to Ishwara and keep away from this as much as possible. That's not what it is, though. It's recognizing this, he says, this whole thing as Ishwara. And in that recognition, that requires that bhakti, praveshtim, he says, you are able to, you enter into that. It means you become that. This body, mind, sense organs becomes Ishwara too. Praveshtim, he says, in reality, tatvaini, in reality you know, you see, and what does that mean? Is that you, the jiva, enters into Ishwara. In fact, there is no jiva. You think there's a jiva. From the standpoint of the jiva has a self, but the self that the jiva has is Bhagavan, is Ishwara, is the Atma, is Brahman. So when you think there's a jiva, the jiva is, all there really is Ishwara. It's the jiva, what creates this jiva to him is ignorance. For you to be a jiva, what does that mean? That you're not Ishwara? I'm a jiva. That means, say if you're a jiva, really, you're a jiva, then Ishwara is limited by you. Because you're a jiva, and Ishwara is Ishwara. So we have a jiveshwara beda. There's all the jivas in the creation. Now, so let's say it in the way that makes it the ridiculous way that it is. There are all these jivas in the creation. Now, how do you say that really? There are all of these selves in the creation. There are all of these little selves in the creation. And I'm one of them. Right? So we're a bunch of little selves in the creation. And then there's Ishwara, the big self. Then there's the Lord. There's the Lord Ishwara, who is the Lord of all of these little selves. Okay, but now the question is the little, is there a little self? Do you have a little self? Mm-hmm. You know? Because if you have a little self and Ishwara has a big self, Ishwara is limited by your little selves. And so it's just that Ishwara is a bigger size. Ishwara is a giant, you know, kind of like, this is silly, but Swamiji's actually used this before, so I'll use it. When you're walking along, what are you? What are you to the ant colony? You're walking along, boom, boom. What, just imagine, what are you to the ants? Now, since, what are you to the microbes? Okay. And so we can be like that to Ishwara. There's a giant Ishwara, you know, which is moving along, and then there's all of these little jivas. That's going to be your experience if you think that you, your being, is this. See what I mean? Because in fact, that's true. In fact, this infinite creation is chewing up everything in it. Everything in this creation, everything on every level is subject to birth and death, birth and death. It's all being chewed up. So the big, huge Ishwara is chewing up all of the little creatures. And that was Arjuna's experience. Mm-hmm. And that's a true experience from the, if you think that you are this. And Arjuna said, please, come back. And give me the form that I'm used to. I can't tolerate this because everything, including himself, would be totally chewed up. And so now the question is, who are you? Are you being chewed up, you know, by Ishwara? It depends on who you are. You know, if you're not the self, if you're not Ishwara, if you're not Brahman, if you're not the self, then you're being chewed up by Ishwara. Mm-hmm. You know?
The body gets chewed up.
The body gets chewed up. Sense organs get chewed up. The mind is on the wildest ride possible. There's punya and papa, karma, taking its toll. you know. And so that's the play of the creation. That's the play of Ishvara. Who are you in that? That's the thing. In your experience, if you just slow down, we're getting a little off the track here, but not really. If you pull back, what you'll find is this infinite display of birth and death on every level, of being eaten on every level. In fact, in some Upanishads, they use this example. Everything is being eaten, continually eaten. You know? But what is your relationship to that eating? To that birth and death? And your relationship is this. Satya Mitya. All of this eating, all of this dream world on every level is taking place in you, and nothing is happening to you at all. Nothing is ever happening to you at all. That's the nature of yourself. Mm-hmm. Nothing happens. Just like when you're in a dream, everything happens, nothing happens. The dream comes, the dream goes. You can have the most real, vivid dream. So many things can be happening. You wake up from the dream is gone. What has happened? Nothing. Nothing has happened. What happened? Well, during the dream, nothing. Nothing has happened. Everything has happened, nothing has happened. That's your experience right now. Change is going on continually. Birth and death is going on continually. Emotions are changing continually. Relationships are changing continually. Mm. And what is happening? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. So that's the Satya Mitya. You recognize in yourself and in all of your experience, all of this is happening, nothing is happening. That is Ishvara. Everything is happening, nothing is happening. I am always untouched. I am always exactly the same. I'm the self of this whole experience. All of this experience is taking place in me, and I am ever untouched by it. That's your experience because you are Ishvara. Ishvara is also not the Ishvara to talk. He's not going to say, you know, oh my God, all of these things are happening to me. All this birth and death is so much as an infinite display of birth and death. I'm being born and dying every second. He would say, birth and death is taking place and taking place and taking place on every level, and nothing is happening to me. I'm the changeless self in which all of this takes place. Let me put it like this. We'll do more of this next week when we finish this chapter. You can sit with your thoughts and your imagination and notice the truth of this without even blinking an eye. As you have an imagination, you can be very creative in the imagination. You can make it a disastrous imagination. Positive, negative, any kind of imagination, horror story, whatever you want. And you can see very clearly that that story is taking place in changeless you. Now the thing is, that is the reality of every experience that you have. There is no experience that's different than that. But you have to notice it. And once you notice it, you notice it more. And as you notice it more, you notice it more. Until when you have nishta, I mean, there's a lot of teaching that has to take place because the Dehatma Buddhi is so big. It's so strong. You go from Dehatma Buddhi to I am Ishvara. That's quite a ways, conceptually. But as you can have as an experiential fact for you because of ignorance that I am this body-mind sense organs, so the body-mind sense organs are saying that, that's not theoretical for you, that's a way that you're actually embracing your experience, where your mind is actually taking, that's how you are defining your experience. You know, it's based on ignorance, but that is your experience. It's like if you mistake a rope for a snake. There's never been a snake there. There's only been a rope there. But that is your experience. That's what you're embracing. That's what you're living, is that experience. It's the same with the tenth man story. The tenth man has totally accepted, embraced, that the tenth man is lost. The tenth man is not lost. The tenth man has never been lost. But the whole emotional reality, is it a snake or the lost tenth man or me as a jiva? You know, I'm only looking at my experience. That which is changing is looking at that which is changing. My eyes are changing, and I'm experiencing, and my eyes, which themselves change, are experiencing a world that is changing. My mind, which itself changes, is experiencing a world that is changing. So the changing is relating to the changing. But nobody's relating to the one that's illumining all changing, which is me. And so that has to, I have to discern myself amidst all of this experience. But once I do that viveka, then everything is changing in me. Everything is changing in me. I am not changing. So everything with that recognition, then what happens is the jiva, the body, the mind, the sense organs, all the points of identification, you know, enter into Ishvara. They're given back to Ishvara. And that's the end of the jiva. The end of the jiva is the recognition there's never been a jiva, really. There's only been Ishvara. Just like if you have a dream or an imagination, there's never been a jiva there. There's only been me. I am the whole story. I am the whole thing. Right? From your standpoint as of the waker, you can say, that whole thing is me, not just part of it. It comes from me, is sustained by me, and goes back to me. Like that, this whole thing is me, not just part of it. It's me, it's both me, and I am free of it. That's the satyamitya. This can't be here away from me, but I am it. But I am free of it, and it depends upon me. That's what we have to recognize. And so, he says in the next verse, he gives, and we'll do that next week, he tells again what the whole, this next verse, it really encapsulates the entire Gita, the teaching of the Gita. It's a very thorough verse. So he concludes the chapter in this way. We'll do it next week. Okay. Next week. Purnamidam Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Something caught my curiosity. When we see ourselves as this changeless conscious being that illumines all these changes and experiences, and you notice it, and then you said, then you notice it again, and you notice it more, and you notice it more. How does that
means the
process
mind,
work?
The mind differentiates. See, the thing is that Your the self of your mind, the me that your mind is, that is Brahman. That is the conscious being. But the mind says, initially, I am the conscious being. Means that, therefore, that whatever thought is there, that's the conscious being. The conscious being is happy. The conscious being is sad. The conscious being is awake. The conscious being is tired. It is just totally, the mind identifies its own vrittis with consciousness itself. But then, with some viveka, with some teaching, what you recognize is that the mind totally enjoys and depends upon, and it's not away from consciousness, but as the vrittis, the thoughts come and go, consciousness doesn't come and go. So then there's something that I notice. The thought is there, I am there. The thought is gone, I'm still there. The mood is there, I am there. The mood is gone, I'm still there. All experiences are like that. The experience is there, I am there. The experience is gone, I'm still there.
Yeah.
And that the mind recognizes. Then it recognizes there's no time. This is the mind talking about this situation.
Yeah.
There's no time that I, the self, am not there. There's no where. There's no time. There's when my being, as I am, is not there, complete and whole. I never go through any modification at all. Nothing can touch me. And then you can do meditations or let me see if I can affect my being in some way. Like, can I become sad? You can be sad. The mind can be sad.
Mm-hmm.
But as the self becomes sad, that's very interesting. When the mind can be agitated, are you agitated?
It seems that way.
That's the viveka. So that's why we even say, you know, we have techniques and everything to calm your mind down, calm your body down, meditative techniques, so that your mind can become very quiet and in a way not in any type of conflict. The nature of, we get your mind to be quiet and relax so that the condition of the mind is relatively harmonious with your own being, your own nature. And then it's fine for you to make a distinction, because the thoughts aren't causing any problems after all, and it's fine to be able to see, you know, when the mind is quiet, then I can recognize my own self. But then, really, your self is there absolutely the same, no matter what the thought is. And so that's the next thing to notice. Oh, my mind is like this, but I am like this. Now my mind is like this, but I'm still like this. Now my mind is like this, and I'm still like this. To go ahead and try to make the differentiation. The problem is that when your mind is in pain, you know, it doesn't care about Brahman or the self. It cares initially. It cares about getting out of the pain.
Yeah, it wants relief.
It wants relief. But actually, you get a tremendous amount of relief once the mind has the wherewithal to say, you know, let me relax into myself, or to notice your own presence amidst that pain. That's actually gives the mind a lot of strength and support, and can actually diminish the pain a great deal. But the main thing, that's one thing, that's a technique that's really helpful for neutralizing pain. But what I'm asking you to look for is this, that just like the sun isn't covered by a rainy, cloudy day, the sun illumines the rainy, cloudy day. From the standpoint of the sun, it's the sun. What's going on? There's a big thunderstorm that it's illumining. Or it's illumining a clear day. It's nothing for the sun. And it's exactly like that. For you, nothing is happening. You're illumining the cloudy day, or you're illumining, you know, the quiet, peaceful mind. Cloudy mind, the peaceful mind, the agitated mind, that's all. You're fine, you're there.
And so how does this build upon, once you start noticing this, how does it build upon itself, or what?
Well, once you notice it, once you notice it, your mind gets used to just noticing it. But why that is helpful is that the nature of the self is so whole and complete and peaceful. What happens is, that's vairagya, really. Vairagya is not this, like keep all of these things. Vairagya is a natural result of knowledge, because the ananda that you're seeking in the world is your own self.
Mm.
It's the source. The source. See, the thing is, when you go after an object, I want this, if I could only have this, I would be happy. You know, that's lack of vairagya. Okay. So if I could just have this, if I could just have this, everything would be so good. I would be happy, you know. And so you go through the struggle of trying to get it, and say things work out and you do get it. Well, there's a whole process as you're starting to fulfill that desire that you wanted this so badly. You do start to relax, and then you fulfill the desire, and then your mind at that moment is desireless, right? When you fulfill a desire, at the moment the desire is fulfilled, you're desireless.
Yeah,
for the moment. But at that moment, your mind is clear,
mm-hmm.
and it gets a burst of ananda in that clarity. But all that burst of ananda is a clean, squeaky clean mind. It's like the difference of holding a muddy mind, a muddy mirror up to the sun, or a clean mirror up to the sun. One reflects the sun and says, "Whoo, this is so nice." And the other feels, "The sun doesn't love me anymore. The sun doesn't shine on me anymore." So that our mind feels that way. If it's agitated and upset because it's not getting fulfilling its desire, then it gets very tense. And it has feelings of isolation and hurt. You know, dark, very dark feelings. But all that is an agitated mind. But say the desire is fulfilled, then the mind is nice and calm. And that mind has an experience which is more in line or more resonant with my own nature. And so when the mind is quiet and calm, I feel like my mind is friendly toward me. It's having experiences that don't feel alien to my own nature. But when the mind is upset, the experiences that are generated in that upsetness are alien to my nature. And so I'd rather have the quiet, shiny experiences of the quiet, peaceful mind, because they're more in line with me. But what if I don't take myself to be the mental experience, positive or negative? What if I've discerned and differentiated me? I'm exactly the same in the positive or negative experience. Right? But that's differentiating me from a happy thought and a sad thought. I'm neither the happy thought or the sad thought. I'm me, the self, that is present equally to both. Nothing ever happens to me. So that's the thing to look for if you think. Otherwise, you have to say like this. I'm only present when there's a happy thought. And since those happy thoughts are gone away, I have no contact with myself. That's the grand illusion. You think that you need the happy thoughts, you know, for yourself, to like get a window into yourself. But are you the thought or are you the self? The self is the one that's illumining the thought, whether it be a happy thought or a sad thought. Just imagine the sun saying, "I can't experience myself now because it's raining outside." That's absolutely untrue. The sun is the sun. Whether it's raining outside or not, it has no effect on the sun. You're the self. You're illumining good weather and bad weather. You're illumining painful thoughts, and you're the very self, the conscious being, because of which the painful thoughts are known, and because of which the happy thoughts are known. You happen to prefer happy thoughts to painful thoughts, but the self doesn't prefer happy thoughts to painful thoughts, and it is its own. You are your own experience. And that self-experience never is tainted or changes in any way. And so that's what to look for in your viveka. Like, what if you say, you know, it doesn't make any sense, but you say, you know, if you say, that's me, or that's me, say, so you say, that's me. That's fine. It's true if you can't get rid of it. Say, ah, that's me. That's who I am. Okay. Then that, you're absolutely correct if there's nothing you can do to get rid of it. If you can get rid of it, even a happy state of mind, oh, oops, that's not me then, because I'm still there, and that part's gone. You can't get rid of yourself. And that's important. So next time you have some terrible thought, unhappy time, you know, say, okay, somewhere amidst this in this muddy room, I am. And see if you can recognize yourself.
And really, I am in everything.
Everything.
Mm.
Yeah.
Viveka, I'm remembering it means distinction or differentiation.
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 Yeah. Like, an example would be the red hot iron ball.
Mm-hmm.
The Viveka, you know, or the Humsa bird that has, where the bird bath is filled with half milk, half water. That's Viveka, where the Humsa bird goes in with its little beak and pulls out all the milk and leaves the water.
Mm-hmm.
Red hot iron ball, it's like the heat, the red hot iron heat pervades fully the iron, so they appear to be one. You know? And that's from the Satya Mitya. Your body, mind, sense organs seem to enjoy consciousness, and they're also finite and subject to change and subject to death, and therefore, am I the conscious being subject to birth and death and change and happiness and sorrow? Because this depends upon consciousness to be. The thing is, consciousness doesn't depend upon it. The dream and rope snake are good examples to.
So this is the only refuge then, is that?
There's no real refuge in the world. Because in the world everything is subject to change. If there's any refuge in the world, what we would say is Dharma. But that doesn't mean that it's just that Dharma itself gives you shanti, and to the degree that your commitment is to Dharma, it's not to things.
Yeah.
But the commitment to Dharma is also really the commitment to Ishvara. Because Ishvara is all of the laws also. So that whole karma yoga buddhi, if your commitment is to Dharma, then the raga dvesha's, the likes and dislikes, are neutralized by that, and so you get much more security, much more sense of security. The degree that your commitment is something has something to do with raga dvesha, pleasure, pain, likes and dislikes, there's not any security. And even the commitment to Dharma is relative security, not absolute security. The only thing absolute security is the Atma, the Self.
When you were earlier speaking about there's nothing that's away from me,
yeah,
and all of this is Ishvara and that's me, and then that sort of evolved into, and the apparent Jiva is also me, it's also apparent, it's not real. But you didn't use that word. But,
oh, what do you mean by that? What I would say is like this, that when you say apparent jiva,
uh-huh,
that's a little confusing. What the jiva is the born of ignorance, the identification by the mind of the self with the sukshma sharira, with the body, mind, sense organs. That's what creates the jiva, that ahankara that unites your conscious being, which is Brahman, with the upadhi. Right, so the jiva has its roots in ajnanam, in self-ignorance.
Yet there's still, even knowing that I am me and Ishvara, there still is a body-mind sense organ thing.
That's right.
In the waking state,
yes.
This one's all, even though it changes,
yeah.
This one called Michael is always here.
Yes.
Well, two things about that. One, that everything is, in everything that is experienced is me, that kind of explains why karma yoga works. Because, you know, at that karma yoga seems to be, in part, accepting graciously, gratefully, whatever occurs.
You accept everything with that prasada buddhi.
With the prasada buddhi.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that happens because it's all me anyway.
That's true. And the nature of ananda and what you seek, really, is only the Atman, is only the self. The source of ananda, or wholeness, that you seek is really only Brahman.
And the sense of that I want something is an illusion.
It's an illusion, because what happens is you superimpose on something in the world ananda, and then you run after it. And then what happens is that if you fulfill the desire, your mind becomes quiet and you get a little burst of happiness. But the source of the happiness, of the ananda, is the self. It has nothing to do with the object. That's why any object, any love item, you know, sometimes is not being loved. Sometimes you like it, sometimes you don't like it, sometimes you don't care about it. Sometimes you like it, and at the same time somebody else hates it, right? And the rest of the world could care less about it. So the ananda, the fullness, has nothing really to do with any object in the world, or it would always be shining, ananda. But what happens is whenever your mind fulfills a desire, the mind becomes quiet at that moment. It's like a clear mirror, clean mirror, shining, you know, being reflected, the sun reflected in a clean mirror. Whenever your mind becomes peaceful, you know, quiet, then it's resonant with your own nature. So you feel, we feel wonderful, because there's no, what do you call it, invader inside. There's no alien force inside, you know, that makes you feel isolated and away from yourself. See what I mean? Like if your mind is, say when your mind is dark and depressed, it's in that condition. And then you feel isolated and away from yourself, because the mind is in a condition, right, that isn't simpatico with your own being.
Can you command?
So you do anything to try to change that. And say you think that, oh, the way to change that condition is to fulfill this desire, or for this person who used to love me to love me again. Or we have all kinds of different things that we think that we need to do in order to get that sense of being full and loved back, because the mind has taken a negative condition, and I'm totally identified with that. I don't recognize the one who's illuminating it.
Can you command your mind to think that way, or how?
The mind has to understand. It's about seeing. It's about knowledge. Not, you can't order it.
Yeah. You could tell the mind, you got to think this way or else.
You know? Captain. That's where, you know, the
it's
mind.
It's odd.
The mind is the one that has the problem, and the mind is the one that needs a solution. And the solution involves knowledge and understanding, you know, not some sort of can't whip it into shape. It has to understand, and it wants to understand.
Mm-hmm. It has to have a friend, right? And if it can't find a friend within itself, it needs to find a friend in the teacher.
It can find a friend in the teacher, but in the end, the good thing about if it finds a friend in the teacher can help the student find really the source, the friend, which is really your own being. What we all seek, we're running around seeking ourself. That's what it is. That's why they say the Kalvyupa, the knowledge in the Upanishad, the greatest secret. Because you are the secret. Right? The self is hidden in the seeker.
Speaking of a mind seeking, getting back to that, so I am all of these experiences, or maybe more precisely, they are contained within me.
Or you could say that satya mitya, where the experience depends on me for its being, but I don't depend upon it. So the experiences mm-hmm. come and go,
mm-hmm.
right? And when mm-hmm. when they exist, the existence that they're enjoying is me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the constant.
Okay, and then there's So there's this body-mind-sense organ system.
Yeah.
It's always around in the waking state.
Yeah.
And then there's this inferential knowing, it may or may not be true, but it's happening here,
yeah,
that there's, at least in this room, eight other of these body-mind-sense organ systems that are having the same kind of thing going on.
Right.
And at some point we're all going to go, you know, maybe some of us will go to the same place, but we're all going to go off. And, you know, here there's going to be whatever Ishwara is manifesting.
Yeah.
And in each other one,
right,
there's going to be a different.
Yeah, like, so you go this way, you go that way.
Yeah.
And then there's the billion people on the other side of the world.
Not to mention that. And aliens
and aliens
and
everybody else, yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know, there's something about that that's, like, it's the same question I tried to ask last Sunday. It's just, it's confusing.
Well, yeah, it is confusing. But you have to think, sometimes maybe the dream analogy helps with this. Like, if you have a dream, there are many people in the dream going in all different directions. Not everybody even knows each other. They have different lives that they're living. There's all kinds of things going on in the dream, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter who it is or where it is. Everyone has the same self. There's only one self. And that entire dream with all its complexity has come from the self, is sustained by the self, and goes back into the self. And so like that, this is a big world with many people in it. And we're all be going and doing our different things. But that's the body-mind-sense organs, which is part of this complex world. And your body and mind and sense organs is different from mine.
Mm-hmm.
Mine will be staying here while you're driving or something, you know. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean, that is not a comment at all about the self. The self isn't driving. If I get up and walk over into my room, my self has not gotten up and walked over into the room. If I, even with space, this example they use, like if I take this cup and I move it through space, I'm not moving space. This is moving through space. But I'm not taking space with me. Right, so there's no such thing really as cup space. I can look in and say, yeah, there's cup space. But there's no cup space, right? And so, somewhat like that, there's no place where the self is not. The self doesn't have time and space, but time and space belongs to the universe, which comes from the self, has the self-consciousness as its being. But there's no place, like, right now, if I ask you to imagine a meadow, you imagine in the meadow imagination with trees and people and animals. In that imagination, time and space and dimension and objectivity and people and all of that are all part of the warp and woof of that imagination. The entire imagination takes place in me. But I'm not becoming big or small because I, the self, am free of time and space. But the time and space and dimension of the imagination also are not separate from me. So when that dimensional space is there, there's no part of it that I don't pervade. However, I'm not doing anything to pervade it, and I myself am free of time and space. That's why I'm what is, actually. And the time-space creation takes place in me. It comes from me, sustained, and resolves into me, and I can never get away from it. It can never get away from me. See, from in this room, like, here I'm 10 feet from you. Okay. But then how many feet am I from consciousness? Your body is 10 feet from this body. But in terms of me, of consciousness, there's no distance.
And there's none for me either.
No. Because
that's what's confusing. Because on one level, there's 10 feet of distance. And we're going to split apart.
Right.
And on another level, there's no distance.
Absolutely. On another level, I am you. It's not even that there's no distance. The conscious being that you are is the conscious being that I am. The minds are different, the sense organs are different, the bodies are different, the dimension is different, but the me is not different. The me, the conscious being, is not something you can look at or objectify or do anything about. It's simply, you simply are. And you'll never not be. You can't do anything about it, about this me. You identify it because your body, that's the Dehatma Vidhi, your body, mind, sense organs will say, yeah, but I am me, and you are you. That's because that conviction of the me being this body is so strong, because why shouldn't it be? Whenever the body is up and awake, and the body mind is up and awake, I am this. That's the mind talking, right? But in fact, the me that I am is not talking. Me is not talking. It is not something I can objectify. It is just me. And what the Vedanta has to say is this me, this very personal me that is me, it is this me that is Ishwara, it is this me that is Brahman, it is this me that is Tibby, my little cat, it's this me that, you know, it's the this me that is you. I am you. Not the, our bodies are different, our minds are different, our sense organs are different, our moods are different, our thoughts are different, our experiences are different, but the me is only one.
When you talk this way, it almost sounds like a separate reality or a different... this me doesn't hold this change. There is no change.
For me, there's no change, but all change takes place in me. It is a different order of reality. But different, it's like this. There's the what we call Paramartika Satyam. That's the order of reality of consciousness. It means you, your being, is not subject to past, present, or future. It can't be negated in past, present, or future. That is what, something real is something that can't come and go. If it comes and goes, it's bordered by non-existence, and so it's not real. So you're the me, is real. Nothing can happen to it. It can never change. It is. Everything else is what we call mitya. Mitya means it can't be categorized as real because it's subject to change. And you can't say it doesn't exist either, because here we're experiencing it. So now, all the whole creation falls into this category called mitya. Now, mitya, being neither real nor non-existent, can't have any being of its own. So it comes into being and goes out of being. So it depends for its being on being itself. It doesn't have being, because it doesn't have existence, because it's bordered by non-existence, you know?
It's the pot, not the clay.
Exactly. But it totally depends upon the clay. Here, this what we call mitya, everything that's subject to birth and death, it totally depends upon what is for it to be.
But there's no connection. I mean,
there's no non-connection either. There's no second thing. Like you say, is there a connection between the rope and the snake? Well, there's a connection of satyam mitya, that the snake is maya. It totally depends upon the rope for its being. You know, it has no reality. It's there, it's experienced, but it has no reality apart from the snake. This creation is here, it's experienced, we have to account for it, the body, mind, sense organs, but it has no reality or no being with apart from the sat-chit, the conscious being. You know?
There's an image that comes up for me. This has been percolating for days and days. And it's kind of like what you're saying, this giant being that's the self, and all these little jivas hanging off of it, you know? And depending on, you know, the self is everything. And the jivas can only experience their little...
There's no jivas hanging off of it. But
think about, it's wrong, it's just it keeps...
Yeah, that's the image. But think like this, maybe. The self, consciousness, is not a knower. You need your mind, the mind and sense organs, to be engaged in this duality. consciousness just simply is self-evident awareness. It's not performing a function. You know, like, right now you simply are. And then with your eyes, you're seeing. With your ears, you're hearing. With your mind, you're thinking and having emotions.
And knowing.
And knowing in terms of subject-object. You know, but consciousness is not knowing something. It just is the knowing without an object. Say if you have knowing or knownness. That's what we mean by self-evident, consciousness. But it has no ears, it has no eyes, it has no mind. Right? It just simply is the very essence of me, of self-evident conscious being. I'm not doing anything. Now when you, to try to understand, you think, oh my God, that's weird. But it isn't weird at all. You're always like that. That's exactly how you are right now. You simply are whole and full and complete. And then there's this all this data going on also. But you're not doing anything. You simply are. You're not knowing. Take away your, if you just mentally, you take away your eyes. Well, now forms aren't there. You take away your ears. Okay, sounds aren't there. You do japa or whatnot and you make your mind quiet, or so the mind is just abiding. That's not there. It doesn't mean anything. Because you're there. You know, it's not like when you're not seeing, you could say, oh, I wish I was seeing. But if you're not seeing, it's still, nothing has happened to you, to your being. So you want to notice. Meditation is good for that, in fact. It's good for a lot of things. But one thing is when you're contemplating and quietening everything down and just going to just abiding, you can ask yourself, am I doing anything? Am I knowing anything? You can even, if you ever do japa and you watch your thoughts come and go, you know, when this thought rises, like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, you do some japa. You can ask yourself, when this thought comes and goes, it's true, the thought is known. You ask yourself, am I knowing it? It is known. Because it's illumined, in fact, by consciousness. But am I doing anything? Am I knowing it? Am I doing any type of activity? Anything, any kind at all. And you're saying, no, I'm not. And I never have, but I never do. Even right now at this moment, you're not doing anything at all.
Or how about, when am I not there? Am I still there?
Yeah.
Am I not there? Maybe now I'm not there.
Yeah. But you're never not there.
Right.
Yeah. You're never not there. I'll do some guided meditations on this.
Thanks.
You have to also unfold it more in different ways. So. Is it enough for tonight?
Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure.